Horizon Investments Economic Call. Hancock Bank provides this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If anybody has any questions throughout the call, please email them to David Lundgren. That's David_Lundgren, LUNDGREN, at HancockBank.com, and we will have time and take the questions at the end of the call. Today on the call, I have John Portwood, Chief Investment Officer for Hancock Horizon Investments, and I have David Lundgren, Director of Equities and Research. Jeffrey Tangus is out on vacation, so we will fill in for him as necessary. Dave, go ahead.
Great. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us again. John, let's start off. The European debt crisis is a topic that seems like we've been covering for well over a year, and it keeps popping up and causing problems for both the economy and the markets. May was no exception, made a lot of headlines. When and how does it end?
I guess first we ought to define who these countries are in the on the southern periphery of Europe that are having all the problem, just to be sure everybody is aware of what they are. They're called the pigs. That's Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. And at the moment, Greece is the center of attention. They're the poster child for the debt crisis in Europe, and they're having more problems than anybody else. It appears that Greece is flat broke. I mean, they have no money. No one believes they have the ability to pay back any of their debt. And so everybody assumes that Greece will eventually default. Up until a few months ago, it was generally thought that Spain and perhaps Portugal would avoid default. Unfortunately, there's now discussion that they may go the way of Greece eventually and have to do some sort of formal restructuring. Ireland is not in great shape either. Ireland is not growing fast enough to pay off their debt, according to the data that everybody sees. So this appears to be a problem that might last for some time unless the European Central Bank and the politicians can agree on some sort of solution that is, I guess, what we might call, the final solution, where you do recognize that it is a solvency issue and not a short-term temporary liquidity issue. But to this point, the politicians in the central bank in Europe have been, as they say, kicking the can down the road. By the way, somebody did a survey about that particular phrase, kicking the can down the road today, and found out that it now surpasses the new normal that we were talking about a couple of years ago as an overused phrase. But in any case, as is typical of most of these kind of problems, you do a little bit here and a little bit there and hope that things get better, and then finally you have to knuckle down and do what is ultimately required. But Greece is teetering on the edge of bankruptcy now, and they're trying to come up with some sort of plan that does not create a credit event, because Moody's has said that if the Greek debt is restructured or reprofiled, as they're calling it now, in some fashion where the interest rate is either reduced or the maturity is extended, it will be a credit event. They will call it a default, and anyone who has sold insurance, credit default swaps, against this event will be called upon under contract to pay the bondholders. Well, who owns all these bonds? Well, it's a lot of the banks in Europe, and that obviously could present some difficulties for them. Rumor has it that France and Germany have provided most of the credit default swaps in the marketplace. If that's the case, they're French and German banks, and they would come under considerable pressure if things don't work out as well as they would hope. So the potential is there, unfortunately, in Europe for a Lehman Brothers moment. And if it does occur, then, of course, that would have some spillover into the rest of the world. But that doesn't mean that they might not be successful in creating some sort of restructuring plan that the market is somewhat comfortable with, and then you have ripples that are created instead of waves in the financial market. But the near-term risk to the markets and economies around the world really lies in Greece and Southern Europe. That's where the real issue is today. At worst, you have a Lehman Brothers moment down the road that creates some riot point in the market. At best, you have a situation that lingers and takes a long time to work out and continues to suppress growth in Europe, which is probably the good result, or, you know, the muddle through over time that we hope will occur. But in any case, it's probably not going to be worked out very soon. There's a potential for some, you know, problems in the market if things don't work well. But in any case, it's going to be with us for quite some time. There's just simply, you know, too much debt on the books of the banks in Europe, you know, from all of these countries for this to be worked out very quickly.
All right, John, let's talk a little bit about the employment front. And May was not pretty for jobs here in the U.S., and last week was especially disappointing. Jobless claims of 422,000, that was the eighth straight week above 400,000. Unemployment rate ticked up to 9.1%. And I guess the most disappointing of all the numbers last week is that employers only added 54,000 new jobs in May, and that was the lowest total in 8 months. It seemed like we had started to make a little bit of progress on the jobs front or employment front, and May was definitely a setback. Does this data represent a significant trend change, or was this just a blip?
It's probably not a significant trend change, but it's a pretty good indication that, you know, the return to full employment as we knew it a few years ago is going to take quite some time. The people who have looked at the numbers very carefully do acknowledge that probably weather had an impact. The Japanese earthquake probably had some sort of ripple effect that affected markets in this country. But aside from that, the numbers are still much weaker than anybody really had anticipated. But when you look at the trend in employment and the improvement in employment following the Great Recession a few years ago, it's still trending upward. So this is probably not a hit-the-wall event where the numbers start running in the opposite direction. And if you go back to what Professors Reinhardt and Rogoff wrote about in their very detailed history of financial crises and the aftermath of credit busts around the world, it takes anywhere from 5 to 7 years to work through all of the issues that are created by the boom and the subsequent bust, and we're only a couple of years down the road. So if you were going to make a guess and say, when are things going to be somewhat normal, well, we may have another 3, 4, 5 years. Who knows, you know, given history before things work out. But something like 7 million jobs, I think. Somebody may try to correct me here in the room about that, were lost during the recession. Only 2 or 3 million have been gained at some of the jobs that were lost from construction and finance, and they're probably not coming back very quickly. So unemployment is liable to remain pretty high for quite some time. And actually, if someone had surveyed us in our organization relative to employment growth and the economy, we would not be particularly surprised by what's happening, because nothing really in the day-by-day and week-by-week data that has come out over the last few years has suggested anything like a normal recovery. You know, nevertheless, I guess the economists believe what they want to believe and continue to project economic growth rates and increases in employment that just simply aren't there and are not likely to be there, you know, given, you know, what's happening and the you know, type of bust we went through. So we think this is probably kind of a normal transition as we move to something more normal down the road, but we just have to get through it.
And, John, you know, generally when you have poor employment data, obviously it indicates a weakening economy. And, again, it appears much like April, May is noticeably slower. Are you concerned? And, you know, we pretty much felt like a double dip was off the table, you know, just a few months ago. Is that still your outlook?
Yes. None of the leading indicators suggest that we're close to a double dip. You know, some of the real sensitive economic indicators, there's one produced by the Chicago Fed. There's another one produced by the Philadelphia Fed that are designed to be somewhat real-time indicators of what's happening in the economy. They're both suggesting below-trend growth, but they are not suggesting that the current picture is anywhere near weak enough to throw us into recession. And when you look at the primary indicators of the economy and you look at where the economy is now compared to where it was in late 2007, the numbers just don't add up to recession. In late 2007, you could make a guess that there was a pretty high probability of a recession down the road, probably fairly close. The numbers just don't add up today to recession. So it looks just like another soft patch like we had last year, and probably it will pass, and the second half of the year may be, you know, a little bit stronger than some people had thought. But now, you know, we're currently seeing projections from the economics group out there in general that the second half of the year may see 3% plus GDP growth. Unfortunately, there's nothing in the data today that makes that guess appear to be fairly accurate. So we would say probably 3% growth in the latter half of the year on average may be a bit too high, just like we thought the projections for 4% for this year at the end of 2009 looked a little bit too high. So everybody appears to be more optimistic than they should be. So, you know, we're guessing that this year will turn out to be kind of like last year, better than 2, probably less than 3. And we're guessing if we do have a number of years left to go before we work through this debt issue that we have, the central tendency of GDP growth may be closer to 2 than 3. So that's just a guess. Of course, we don't always know exactly what's going to happen, but that appears to be a more realistic assessment than what you see from most of the economists.
Okay, thank you. Let's talk about stocks a little bit. May was difficult for the it was the first negative month for the S&P 500 since August of 2010. The return for the S&P 500 was negative 1.1%, which brings the year-to-date number to a still pretty strong 7.8%. The market has had quite a run, and I guess to a certain degree you could say we were due. May was volatile, but I guess being down 1.1% wasn't all that bad. Although, you know, May wasn't that bad, June has started out to be pretty sloppy. We hit a 2.5-month low on the S&P 500 yesterday. Are we about to enter a dangerous period for the market here, and will valuation act as a support from a major pullback?
It still looks like correction rather than major top. There are some technical indicators that suggest the market's having some trouble moving higher. You know, different groups and sectors are beginning to weaken a bit. Things that are pretty characteristic of an approaching correction of some sort. In terms of valuation obviously is not as good as it was back in late 08 and early 09, but neither is the valuation picture as stretched as it was in late 2007. So I would guess that any correction now would be relatively shallow, given that the valuation picture, you know, while not outstanding, is nothing like it was, you know, back in 2007. Plus, while the peak in corporate earnings growth momentum was several months back, the picture is still positive. I mean, corporate earnings are still going up. They're just not going up at the rate they were. So that still provides, you know, should provide some support for the market. But short run, it's always hard to make a guess as to what's going to happen unless you can, you know, see it happening right in front of you. And right now, the picture looks a little weaker, but not substantially weaker. I think the real risk today to a major sell-off in the market is an unusual event, you know, something that creates a non-economic decline. And I'll bring up two instances in history to give you an example of what I'm talking about. In 1962, President Kennedy threatened the steel companies with price controls if they didn't lower prices among themselves. Well, the market hates to hear any talk of price controls or anything like that, and the market dropped about 30% in less than 2 months. It was not an economic event. The market came back, and things continued. 1987, classic case of a non-economic event where stocks were really too high and over exploited, I guess you might say. Everybody was in. Interest rates were rising a bit. And when the market broke, something called portfolio insurance, which is not used today, accelerated the decline, and you had a decline of about 30% in about 2 weeks. It was really one of the biggest crashes we've had in quite some time. But it was not an economic event. So a year, 18 months later, you know, stocks had recovered all of their losses and things moved on. So I think that the risk now would be some sort of non-economic event, say Greece blows up, you know, withdraws from the euro and goes back to the drachma and tells everybody to take a hike and we're not going to pay you. Something like that would create a big sell-off in the market probably. But from an economic standpoint, there would not seem to be a reason to expect a severe sell-off at this point.
Okay. Sounds good to me. In terms of interest rates, we've seen a pretty significant move since the end of April. If you look at the yield curve, from 3 years and out, 3, 5, 10, 30 year, rates are down anywhere from 30 to 40 basis points across the curve. Would you say that this is a result of flight to safety in lieu of some of the things going on with the European debt crisis and some issues here domestically, or is it just economic weakness and a lack of pricing power that's causing this move?
I guess you could say all of the above. It's probably a combination of economic weakness or, say, a lack of strong economic growth here and a flight to safety given the situation in Europe. But when you think about interest rates, the primary driver of interest rates and yields on bonds is going to be inflation. That's the highest correlation over time is between inflation and bond yields and bond prices. Currently, there are forces of deflation that are working to suppress any inflation that might occur, and you know, that can be seen in the fact that people, companies are not borrowing, lending, and spending as much as they did in the past. The Fed has created a lot of excess reserves on the books of the commercial banks, but it's just sitting there; nobody's using it. The velocity of money, which is a measure of the turnover of dollars in the economy, which has you know, a lot to do with measuring you know, how enthusiastic people are about expanding businesses or spending money, fell like a stone in 2008 during the crash, and it flatlined ever since. Unfortunately, recently the velocity of money is declining again, which indicates that the money supply is probably declining as well. So that's not a good sign in terms of rapid economic growth. So it's another one of those indicators that suggests economic growth is going to be relatively slow, perhaps for some time. And it's also an indicator that if nobody's going to use all this money that the Fed has put out there in excess reserves, that you're not going to have inflation and you're not going to have rising interest rates. And it, you know, how long that's going to last is anybody's guess. But, you know, our inclination would be at this point to avoid owning cash reserves, which pay nothing, and at least own some bonds and fixed income securities, because you get paid something, and it doesn't appear that inflation is a near-term threat that would, you know, impact that kind of investment. So we're somewhere between, maybe we're in limbo, I guess. Maybe inflation is going to happen down the road. But the conditions just don't support it at this time.
John, an event that I guess could affect interest rates, the market, the economy, et cetera, is the end of quantitative easing. The second round of quantitative easing by the Fed is scheduled to end this month. What happens when the Fed stops this program? And is a third round of quantitative easing even a remote possibility.
Listening to the Federal Reserve presidents, the people who vote, and there was a guy on, Richard Fisher from Texas was on the news this morning, answering some questions in a conference call on CNBC. It would seem that QE3 or something like it is probably becoming more unlikely as time goes on, because as everyone is aware, it really didn't do much for wealth creation in the country. It probably juiced commodity prices a bit and got the stock market going. But in terms of doing anything for the economy, nobody has found any measurable result. Now, when it ends, and of course it will end very soon, that's already in the market. Everybody knows it. Everybody anticipates it. But what it looks like the Fed will do is continue to maintain that excess reserve position in the banks, continue to keep things sort of stable as they are, just not, buy any more bonds. And so there won't be any tightening of monetary policy. Now, theoretically, I guess, if they're not buying treasuries, somebody else has to step into the breach and buy them. So I guess from a supply-demand standpoint, you might argue that if they're not buying and there isn't a buyer to take their place, interest rates on treasuries might rise a bit. I don't really know. I mean, it might happen, but here again, we know that the Chinese are still buying, we know the Japanese are still buying, and, a lot of people are still buying our debt. So, we'll just have to see. But I wouldn't expect the result to be, anything particularly sudden. I think if we were going to see it, we'd already see it today probably, and we don't.
Okay, thanks, John. That concludes our prepared questions. If anybody has a question, please email me at david_lundgren@hancockbank.com. And, John, I do have a couple questions that have come in already. The first one is in regards to interest rates and housing. Will the recent drop in interest rates help housing at all?
Housing is already pretty affordable, and I doubt if rates falling much beyond where they were in the last month or two will have a significant impact. There just simply aren't really enough buyers out there, and there are too many sellers. And obviously that varies by state and by region, and we all know where the real problems are. They're in California, Arizona, Florida, Nevada. Other parts of the country, the situation is not quite as dire because you don't have as many foreclosures. But the pool of buyers, even though housing is more affordable, has been reduced substantially. Now 20% down is becoming more of a normal requirement. That reduces the pool of potential buyers. There's probably also a reluctance on the part of some people who are trying to sell their house to recognize where prices really are today, and there's still probably some price reductions coming. It looks like a situation where housing is bouncing along the bottom and probably is going to be pretty much of a dull area for maybe a very, very long time. Once you come out of a housing bust, and people probably have seen some of these charts I've used in the past in some presentations. You have a massive bubble like that. Whatever was the subject of the bubble and the subsequent bust usually remains in the doldrums for a very long time. It could happen to gold. It happened to oil in the past. It happened to technology after the technology bust. And now it's happening to housing. So, housing may... In general, I guess, other than what might happen in some regional situation, is probably going to remain relatively flat for maybe another decade. I mean, that tends to be the way these things play out. It takes a very, very long time for something to normalize after you go through a big bubble like that. Unless something changes in the population mix, and nobody really expects that. Now, I'll give you an example. North Carolina has this is just personal story from my son. My son's trying to buy a house in North Carolina, and he lives right outside of Raleigh in a little town called Cary. And North Carolina's been, a pretty good place to be outside of what happened around the tech bust. in terms of housing and general business conditions, and they probably have lower unemployment than some other areas, and you really don't notice any particular strain in North Carolina. Now, Charlotte's having a problem because that's a big financial hub, and, you know, finance is not doing well, and so I think house prices in Charlotte are continuing to decline. They were down about 6%, but not quite so bad around Raleigh. Things have been relatively stable for a while, but my son has been trying to find some comps, some sales that have happened, say, in the last 6 months, in the price range where he's looking, and he found two. So not much is moving. You know, the prices don't seem to be down substantially from where they were a few years ago, but there are no sales. So that probably gives you a pretty good idea of what's happening in a lot of areas of the country where you never really had a big problem, but sales are just very slow. And, you know, it may continue that way for quite some time. Now, one thing is true, and y'all have probably seen these statistics. You can probably see it around here. Anything that's, say, over $500,000 in Raleigh or that area, for example, takes 6-7 months to sell. And my guess is here in New Orleans, it probably takes 6-7 months to sell something, maybe longer. There's a house down the street from me that's really a beautiful house, been for sale off and on for over 2 years, and they can't even get an offer on the thing. And it's really a very nice house, but it's kind of high-priced, but, you know. So there we are, I guess, you know. And housing, by the way, is not going to be – it's not going to come back and be an added thrust to you know, economic development either. I mean, that's sort of out the window, and it was normally a contributor to economic growth in the past, and it won't be anymore. So something else has got to take its place. But until people feel more comfortable about spending money and borrowing money, it's probably not likely to happen. Have I got any more time, Dave? I'm getting on a roll here.
Well, I got a couple more questions, more question. So let's go ahead and shift gears a little bit. The question is, will real deficit reduction come out of Washington this year, and will the debt ceiling be raised?
The last time we had this debt ceiling issue was in 1993, the Clinton administration, and there was an argument then about debt and deficits, and Moody's, or one of the rating agencies, threatened to lower the rating on U.S. debt unless, you know, the debt ceiling was raised. Well, of course it was, and we passed on. And now, unfortunately, the long-term debt picture is much worse, and everybody realizes that something significant has to be done to reduce the debt and the deficit in the long run. Current thinking is, I believe, that, you know, some sort of agreement will be reached, and we won't have a little mini-crisis moment here, but I don't think anybody is completely sure of that. In the long run, and there's good news and bad news in this comment. You know, the bad news is that if you read research papers written by people we all consider to be extremely smart, extremely perceptive about what's going on, and extremely knowledgeable about economics and the markets, none of this group believes that we will get out of this debt and deficit issue without another financial crisis, because they don't believe the politicians will do what they need to do in time to avoid another crisis. Now, the good news about all that is that usually when everybody gets on one side of an issue like that, something else is going to happen. And in this case, it may be that we actually work through it much earlier than anybody thinks, and also without a lot of disruption. But just to give you an idea of what the smart crowd thinks, they don't think we'll get out of it alive, you know, without having some other kind of crisis down the road about the debt and the deficit. Problem is, of course, it requires probably higher taxes and a substantial reduction in spending to make it work. By the way, I'm putting some of this in the highlights that's been somewhat delayed, but I'll just mention a few things. Economists talk about financial repression or financial oppression as a tool used to get out of a debt problem and a deficit problem, you know, in sort of a stealthy way. That's when the politicians figure out a way to change rules and regs and taxes to force or encourage people to buy bonds at negative interest rate yields. You know, it's happened in the past. It'll probably happen in the future. Along those same lines, Argentina seized pension plans to help support government spending in a crisis they had a few years ago. They just seized all the private pensions they'd given to us. Ireland is taxing private pensions to support welfare spending while they go through an austerity program to try to avoid default. You may have read in the past about suggestions and research reports trying to justify taxing or seizing in some matter 401k plans and IRAs to help the government. And that's still talked about from time to time. So, you know, people would consider that, you know, a pretty extreme measure. But I have always told people to forget about Roth IRAs, take the current IRA and use the current IRA and the tax deduction, because a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. And you never know. Down the road, the tax law might change, and you might find that IRAs, Roth IRAs, everything gets taxed in some fashion in a way that you never imagined. And you may not remember this, but prior to 1983, Social Security was non-taxable. You know, that was not added to taxable income. And everybody at the time figured that the government had an unwritten, inviolate contract with retirees whereby Social Security income would not be taxed. That changed in 1983. That was Reagan signed it and had bipartisan support. And that was when they said up to 50% of Social Security income, depending on your income level outside of Social Security, could be taxed or be added to your taxable income. Sometime in the 90s, it was raised to 85%. I wouldn't be surprised to see it be 100 fairly soon. So all of these things are probably on the table and out there that the politicians will consider, you know, as we go through this debt deficit problem and try to resolve it. So you never know exactly how it's going to work out. But, you know, when they say everything is on the table, given what's happened around the world and what's happened here in the past, I would say probably everything is on the table. So if you get a tax break today, I would say take it, and don't count on having the same tax break in the future. I know that's not a very pleasant thing to think about, but nevertheless, it's something that might happen.
Okay, John, yeah, one more question, and for the sake of time, I'm going to answer it. Is it true historically the third year of the presidential term means stocks do well? And I think the answer is yes. Third year of presidential term has been very good for stocks. Do you want to add anything real quick to that?
No, I think that's what the cycle suggests. So
great.
Okay, we're out of time, so thank you everyone for listening in the call. If you have any questions or have any comments about the call, you can email me or Dave and let us know what you think. Thanks again for participating, and we'll talk to you next month. Thanks. Bye.